Good morning. It's good to see everybody here today, especially if you're visiting with us. We want you to feel especially welcome today. Excuse me. As Patrick said, I'm not the regular preacher, and I'm sure that's going to be painfully obvious pretty quickly that I'm not the regular preacher. But hopefully we can find something in our study today that'll be beneficial to all of us. I'd like to start the lesson today by looking at Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 11. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 11. There we read, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. And this sounds like things don't always work out the ways that we think they will or the way that we think that they should. And another way of saying it would be that things don't always turn out how we think is fair. If things were fair, you'd expect the fast person to always win the race. If things were fair, you'd expect the strong to always win the battle. We hear a lot about how things aren't fair. You'll hear someone say, well, it's not fair that this person has more money than I do. It's not fair that this person has more power than someone else. How do politicians do what they do and get away with it? And just like the song Tempted and Tried says, tempted and tried, we're all made to wonder why it should be thus all the day long, while there are others living about us, never molested, though in the wrong. So if life were fair, you would think things would go differently. And the list of things that people say aren't fair goes on and on. And I know that sometimes it creeps into my life. I like to think, oh yeah, I learned at an early age but that life isn't fair. But I still react in ways that prove that I obviously need to remember that. It could be something as silly as someone cutting me off in traffic, or if I hear about someone who's being mistreated or things like that, sometimes my first thought is, well, I need to get even with them, you know. And that's not the way to look at it. We shouldn't be looking at things, oh, that's not fair, so I need to get even. We need to have a different kind of attitude than that. And when I'm acting like that, saying, oh, I need to get even, what I'm really doing is, at that moment, I'm being immature, and I'm getting worked up over something that's insignificant, and I really don't need to be that worked up over it just because I don't think it's fair. We're told early in life, you know, we're told as kids, life's not going to always be fair, but it's a hard lesson for some of us to learn and some of us to remember at times. And sometimes when I think about how I acted, I need to remind myself of all the things that Jesus went through and how, you know, he could have retaliated and taken revenge, but that's not what he did. If we look over in Matthew 26, verse 53, Matthew 26, 53, this is on the night of Jesus' betrayal when they're coming to arrest him. And some of his apostles are going to defend him. He says, you know, he tells them in verse 52, he says, Jesus said to him, put your sword in its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. And then in verse 53, it says, or do you think that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels? So, I mean, there's things that Jesus could have done to get out of what he was going through had he chosen, you know, but he didn't. And so there's times when I'm thinking, well, I'd like to do something, and I don't really have any right to think that way, you know. And he had the right to think that way, and he didn't do that. So it makes me feel pretty silly and pretty small when I compare me getting worked up over something so insignificant and then seeing how he acted and how I acted. So I'd like to spend a few minutes this morning looking at a couple of examples from the Bible of people who were treated unfairly and how they dealt with how they were treated. And the first person I'd like to discuss this morning is Joseph. So if you turn with me over to Genesis chapter 37, there we're going to read of how Joseph's brothers had hatred for Joseph due to him being his father's favorite and for some of the dreams that Joseph has had. In Genesis 37, starting in verse 3, there we read, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. And his brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept it in mind. So their envy and hatred became so much that they started to plot to kill him. If you read further in the same chapter, in verse 18, it says, "Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, 'Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams.'" So it's hard to imagine having such strong dislike, hatred, anger toward your brother that you'd plot and plan to kill him. But that's what they were planning to do. But one of Joseph's brothers, Reuben, had overheard their plot to kill him, and he was trying to talk them out of killing him, and he came up with a plan where he would seem like he's going along with it, but then he'd come back later and rescue Joseph and return him to his father. In verses 21 and 22, it says, "But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, 'Let us not kill him.' And Reuben said to them, 'Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him to the hand out of their hands and bring him back to his father.'" So his plan was to come back later and rescue him and bring him back home. But as we know, his plan didn't work out just exactly the way he had planned it, though. Reading on in verse 23, "So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, 'What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh.' And his brothers listened. Then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt." At verse 27, it kind of strikes me as odd when he says, "Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." I guess selling him into slavery was okay, but killing him wasn't it. That just seemed like an odd thing for them to say there. But apparently Reuben wasn't around when this took place, because when he came back later, he was going to go down and rescue Joseph, and he realized that he was gone. And reading on in verse 29, it says, "Then Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit. And he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, 'The lad is no more, and I, where shall I go?'" And then in reading on in verses 31 through 35, we read of how they deceived their father and made him believe that Joseph had in fact been killed. It says there, "So they took Joseph's tunic, killed the kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, 'We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?' And he recognized it and said, 'It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces.' Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, 'For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning.' Thus his father wept for him." So not only had his brothers agreed to sell him into slavery, but now they've tormented his father by convincing him that his favorite son had been killed. And then over in verse, if we go over to chapter 39, there we read of how Joseph was sold and he was a slave of Potiphar, and how he became trustworthy because he worked hard and he took on more and more responsibility serving Potiphar. So in Genesis 39, starting in verse 1, "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And so everything's going fairly well. I mean, he is a slave, but he's shown his worth to Potiphar, and he's being, you know, given more and more responsibility and maybe more freedom that goes along with that. But then if we continue reading, we read of the trouble that comes upon Potiphar because of the lies and everything that Potiphar's wife tells about him. Reading on in verse 7, it says, "And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, Lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her, to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time, when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house were inside, that she caught him by the garment, saying, Lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. And so it was, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called to the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, See, he has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside. So she kept his garment with her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with words like these, saying, The Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came in to me to mock me. So it happened as I lifted my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled outside. So it was when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, Your servant did to me after this manner, that his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison. So now not only has Joseph been sold into slavery by his brothers, but now he's been placed in the prison because of the lies told by Potiphar's wife. And we all know what happens next. We know the story of Joseph being in prison and interpreting the dreams of his fellow prisoners, the Pharaoh's butler and baker, and how it took the butler 2 years to remember Joseph once he was released, and to mention him after Pharaoh had a dream that no one else could interpret. And as a result of Joseph interpreting Pharaoh's dream and telling him about the famine to come, Joseph is released from prison, and once again he's given a position of authority in Egypt. Turning over to chapter 41, starting in verse 39, Genesis 41:39, there it says, Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. So, once again, Joseph is now he's in a position of more authority than he was before he was placed into prison. And then later on, there's a famine in the land, just as Joseph had said there would be when he interpreted Pharaoh's dream. And as a result of this famine, Joseph's brothers come to Egypt to get some grain, because Egypt had known about the famine that was coming, and Egypt was prepared more than the areas around. And then we read over in Genesis chapter 42 and verse 8 what happens when Joseph sees his brothers. It says, So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And I'm afraid that if I were Joseph and they came to me for grain, that I probably wouldn't have been as generous and as nice as they were. My first thought would probably have been, okay, I know what you guys did to me. You guys are going to prison. But luckily, that's not how Joseph handled it, and that's not what he did. In Genesis chapter, if we go over to Genesis chapter 47, verse 11 and 12, It says, "And Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. Then Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with bread according to the number in their families." So instead of Joseph doing what I probably would have done and seeking revenge against his brothers, instead he does just the opposite. He provides them a place to live. He provides them food. He takes good care of them. I mean, he's a perfect example of how to react when you feel like you're treating them unfairly. Like I said, his brothers had sold him into slavery and all these bad things had happened to him, but after all that, he was still willing to forgive his brothers and help them get started, help them with a place to live, take care of them, provide them food. And the next example I'd like to look at is in the New Testament. I'd like to read a little bit about the life of Jesus. If we turn over to Matthew chapter 4, and if we look at verses 23 and 24, this tells of the early days of Jesus' ministry and how he's spending his time helping people, healing people, and teaching people. Matthew 4, 23 and 24. "And Jesus went about all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease among the people. Then his fame went throughout all Syria, and he brought to him all sick people who were afflicted with various diseases and torments, and those who were demon-possessed, epileptics, paralytics, and he healed them." And we have several other examples of Jesus helping others, healing others. We can read over in Matthew chapter 8, starting in verse 1. It says, "When he had come down from the mountain," talking about Jesus, "when he had come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him. And behold, a leper came and worshipped him, saying, 'Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean.' Then Jesus put out his hand and touched him, saying, 'I am willing, be cleansed.' And immediately his leprosy was cleansed." And in the same chapter, over in verse 14, "Now when Jesus had come into Peter's house, he saw his wife's mother lying sick with a fever. So he touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she arose and served them. When evening had come, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. And he also gave his apostles the power to heal people." Over in Matthew chapter 10, in verse 1, "And when he had called his 12 disciples to him, he gave them power over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease." And we read in Matthew chapter 12, verses 10 through 13, we read about the question of whether he should heal someone on the Sabbath. Matthew 12 and verse 10, "And behold, there was a man who had a withered hand, and they asked him, saying, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?' that they might accuse him. And he said to them, 'What man is there among you who has one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value then is a man than a sheep? Therefore it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath.' Then he said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand,' and he stretched it out, and it was restored as whole as the other." But then so far we just read about him doing good. He's teaching, he's helping people, he's healing people. So you would think, well, you know, if you didn't know the story already, you would think, well, this should be, everyone should love him and there shouldn't have any problems. But it's just the opposite. If we read on in verse 14, we'll read something that we're going to read over and over again. It says, "Then the Pharisees went out and plotted against him how they might destroy him." So instead of worshiping him, accepting him, loving him for what he is, for all the good he's doing, they're seeking a way to get rid of him and to kill him. And then we can go over to Matthew chapter 14, and we can read of Jesus feeding the multitudes that were following him. Matthew 14, starting in verse 13, it says, "When Jesus heard it, he departed from there by boat to a deserted place by himself. But when the multitudes heard it, they followed him on foot from the cities. And when Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude, and he was moved with compassion for them and healed their sick. And when it was evening, his disciples came to him, saying, 'This is a deserted place, and the hour is already late. Send the multitudes away, that they may go into the villages and buy themselves food.' But Jesus said to them, 'They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat.' And they said to him, 'We have here only 5 loaves and 2 fish. He said, 'Bring them here to me.' Then he commanded the multitudes to sit down on the grass, and he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and broke and gave the loaves to the disciples, and the disciples gave to the multitudes. So they all ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of the fragments that remained. Now those who had eaten were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. So in addition to teaching and healing people, now he's fed the multitudes by a miracle. And then in Luke, we read about him healing the 10 lepers. Luke chapter 17, verses 12 through 14. It says, "Then as he entered a certain village, there met him 10 men who were lepers who stood afar off. And they lifted up their voices and said, 'Jesus, Master, have mercy on us.' So when he saw them, he said to them, 'Go show yourselves to the priest.' And so it was, as they went, that they were cleansed." So, I mean, that's a great story. You know, you would think they're all going to be grateful that he healed them. But if we read on, we see that only one of them came back to thank him. Reading on in verse 15. "And one of them, when he saw that he was healed, returned and with a loud voice glorified God and fell down on his face at his feet, giving him thanks. And he was a Samaritan. And Jesus answered and said, 'Were there not 10 cleansed? Where are the 9? Were there not any found who returned to give glory to God except this foreigner?'" I get offended when I hold a door for someone and they don't say thank you. And that's nothing compared to healing someone of leprosy. So it's just hard to believe that they wouldn't come back and be thankful for what he had done. But it also shows me that why would I think someone's going to thank me for doing something small when all that he did and no one came back, and only one person came back to thank him. So I have to remember that, you know, I guess I can be petty at times. So I have to remember that, you know, things aren't going to go my way all the time, and I need to realize what's important and what's not. So we've looked at several examples of Jesus helping others, teaching them, healing them, feeding them, giving his apostles the power to heal them. And if life on earth was fair, everyone would have loved Jesus. Everyone would have worshipped him. Everyone would have followed after him. Everyone would have been grateful for all that he did. But we know that that's not how it worked out. We know that the religious leaders of that time despised Jesus and the threat that they viewed him toward their status in society. In Matthew 26, 3 and 4, we read again of them plotting to kill Jesus. Matthew 26, starting in verse 3, there it says, "Then the chief priest, the scribes, and the elders of the people assembled at the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and plotted to take Jesus by trickery and kill him." And later on in Matthew 26, verses 45 through 50, we read of Judas betraying Jesus. After Jesus had selected Judas as one of his apostles, and he'd been able to follow Jesus around, he'd seen all the wonders, all the works, all the miracles that Jesus had done, still he betrays Jesus. And starting in verse 45, it says, "Then Jesus came to his disciples and said to them, 'Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand.' And while he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude with swords and clubs, came from the chief priests and the elders of the city. Now his betrayer had given them a sign, saying, 'Whomever I kiss, he is the one. Seize him.' Immediately he went up to Jesus and said, 'Greetings, Rabbi,' and kissed him. But Jesus said to him, 'Friend, why have you come?' Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and took him." And then we know later in chapter 26, they try and try to find false witnesses that'll lie to convict Jesus. Reading in verse 59, "Now the chief priests, the elders, all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at last two false witnesses came forward and said, 'This fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days.'" And we know of all the mistreatment that Jesus endured on that night prior to his crucifixion. We can read down in verses 67 to 68, all the mockings and the beatings. There it says, "Then they spat in his face and beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hands, saying, 'Prophesy to us, Christ, who is the one who struck you?'" And then over in Matthew 27, we see a familiar phrase again. "When morning came, all the chief priests and elders of the people plotted against Jesus to put him to death." And then there's we read about the tradition of they had of releasing a prisoner, and so they had the option of releasing Jesus, or they had the option of releasing Barabbas. And Barabbas is referred to as, what's the word? Notorious prisoner. So they had the opportunity, the choice to choose between releasing a notorious prisoner or releasing innocent Christ. And due to the beckoning of the scribes and Pharisees, they said, well, you release Barabbas and kill Christ. And, you know, we know about the continued mockings, the continued beatings that went on during that night. Matthew 27 and verse 26. There it says, he released Barabbas to them, and when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. Then the elders of the governor took Jesus in the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him, and they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. And when they had twisted a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and a reed in his right hand. And they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews. And then they spat on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they took the robe off him, put his own clothes on him, and led him away to be crucified. There's absolutely no way in the world I could have withstood what he withstood if I had the ability to fight back. I mean, knowing that he had the ability to get out of that situation and he chose not to, I can't imagine the love and everything that he had to be able to do that, because I couldn't have done that. And in Luke's account of the crucifixion, we read of Jesus' love for others. If you look in Luke chapter 23 and verse 34, Luke 23 and verse 34. There it says, while he's on the cross being crucified, Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. And they divided his garments and cast lots. After all he'd endured, all the abuse, the beatings, everything that had happened to him, everyone plotting to kill him, now hanging on the cross, being murdered, he still has the love for his Father and his love for man to pray for their forgiveness. And what a great example he is of how we should react to people and things that confront us. None of us will ever face anything anywhere near what Jesus faced and what he endured, but still, some of us may fail to react as we should. I know I do. And, you know, when you compare what we face and what I face and how I react to what he faced and what he reacted, it embarrasses me. There are many other people that we could read about and you know, that we could talk about that had suffered things that we would consider unfair. There's Stephen being stoned and being killed. There's Abel being murdered. There's the things that Job endured. There's Paul. The list goes on and on. And if you look in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 36, Hebrews 11, 36. There we read, still others had trials of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. So obviously, that proves to us there, this life's not fair. I mean, people that are serving God and worshiping God should never have those kind of things happen to them. And nothing that we ever face in this life will compare with the glory that we can enjoy in heaven. Romans 8:18 tells us that. Romans 8:18 says, for I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. So we need to remember that when things don't seem to be going fair, that our reward is not in this life, not on this earth, but in heaven. This should help us to be able to endure and tolerate mistreatment and help us to respond in the way that we should. We know life isn't fair, but we must do all that we can to live as we should. We've looked at a couple of examples today of people who were severely mistreated and still showed love and forgiveness toward those who had wronged them. Hopefully this will be helpful for us when we face what we view as unfair treatment, and we can remember how they reacted, and maybe that'll help us to react as we should. If there's anyone here today that needs to respond to the invitation for any reason at all, please do so as we stand and as we sing.